둘, 셋, 파!
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans.
$829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Do hit that subscribe button while you're hanging around. I'll give you new interviews just like this one every single week at anywhere you get your podcasts. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. Those always help out so much. We've had some great guests on the show lately, including Ann and Nancy Wilson of Hearts, Cindy and Kate from the B-52s. We talked with Pavement, actress Troyan Belisario. She's starring in On Call. You also know Troyan from Pretty Little Liars. Chris Robinson of the Black Crowes, Desi Leidick of The Daily Show, Kim Deal of The Breeders, Colin Greenwood of Radiohead, Maynard James Keenan from Tool, Les Claypool from Primus, Patrick Gibson starring in Dexter, Original Sin, Dave Navarro from Jane's Addiction, Pearl Jam, Stone Gossard, just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's another Rewind episode. We're looking back at a nice little retrospective of my interviews with Sonic Youth, specifically Kim Gordon, Lee Ranaldo, and Thurston Moore, because noise rock never ages. It just gets louder. Kim will be dissecting Airbnb Decor and Fleetwood Mac's Tusk. Lee will be explaining how to keep a band together by not asking too many questions, and Thurston doubles down on mixing avant-garde riffs with classic rock solos, a nostalgic, messy, and brilliant look back at one of music's most uncompromising bands. And let's start in 2010. That's when I spoke with Lee Ranaldo about the final Sonic Youth album, The Eternal. It's part one of Kyle Meredith with Sonic Youth.
I mean, it's a very hard thing to put your finger on. I mean, what keeps a band going for, you know, almost 30 years? I mean, it's kind of something we you know, I don't know, we've gotten used to not questioning it in a way. But I think that partly it comes down to the fact that we remain very, very interested in playing music together and in making music, you know? I mean, we've kind of, like, never been involved in this for any of these kind of extracurricular means, you know, not for money or for fame or anything like that. I mean, we're into playing music, We're into playing music together. I think we recognize that we've got some kind of very interesting thing that goes on when we play together. And it's just, I think it's as simple as that, that we've just never gotten bored of the process. Well, you know what? It's been a great change for us. We had a very good relationship with Geffen Records, where we were for like almost 20 years. And I think what happened was we just got, with all the changes that have gone on in the music business, it just got less and less interesting for us to be there. We were less and less used to anybody. There was no one there that we could talk to. There was no one there that was really interested in the same things we were. And going to Matador was kind of like coming home to, you know, some of the people there worked on our very earliest records. The records they put out have always been of interest to us in terms of the type of music they've been working with, and, you know, and stuff that feels close to what we love. And you know, a lot of our friends have been there over the years, Cat Power, Pavement, and just like all kinds of people that we respect and acknowledge as musical artists. And it just seems a much better fit to us right now. I mean, there's tons of people there that are excited about music and interested in what we're doing and what's going on in music, and it just works. It's been working really well for us. You know what? This entire the process of this entire record has been so great. Playing live, we've been so enthusiastic about playing this record. I mean, it's not really like I'd even single out any particular song. It's been an amazing group of songs to play live. We've had so much energy and enthusiasm on stage playing this new music. You know, for whatever reason, I think we've been having more fun on stage than we have in years. Just because we've really got a great group of songs to play, and it's just been really, really incredibly fun to play this stuff. Yeah. So, you know, we played all summer in the U.S. and we've been kind of going back and forth to Europe a little bit, and it's just been really, really fun. The band is really in a great place right now. Well, you know what, we've played them so much that. Yeah, we do like it that way. Our great enthusiasm is always for, because we play so many shows, you know, we've played each song lots and lots of times. And so our enthusiasm is usually for the most recent stuff, just because it's the freshest, it's the stuff we're most close to in terms of whatever, you know, stylistic stuff or technical stuff we're working on. And yeah, it's really, really the most fun for us to play new stuff. And you know, it really also, I think, helps you feel like you're still very current, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we like to play songs that people want to hear, and we try to play songs that people want to hear from past records. But our main interest is just in moving forward, and so that means, you know, playing the new material. You know, we do get to take breaks. I mean, I don't know if breaks are the most interesting thing in the world for us. I mean, you know, we it's the same thing as you know, why the band keeps going, in a sense. It's just that we all have all this stuff that we are interested in trying to do, and we've managed to have some opportunities to do different things, you know, whether it's in music or visual art or books or whatever. And you know, we're just enthusiastic and ready to go on doing new stuff. So there's lots of stuff we want to do. So I think that we're all just hard workers who are really like to work. Well, we're finishing out the year. We're starting January with a few more Eternal shows out in California, and then we're jumping right into some soundtrack work. We were in France a month ago, and we met with this young French director who's doing his first film. It's kind of a teen film or a youth film with a little bit of a murder mystery aspect to it, and we really liked what we saw. And so we're gonna do the soundtrack to his film for the next couple months. Beyond that, I think we're planning, you know, we've got this art show that's touring in Europe that's going to open in Madrid in the end of January. That'll be the fifth location of that, and at some point we'll go over there and play a show for the art show. And I guess at some point, you know, besides some of our archival projects that we've got going on, I guess at some point we'll think about writing some tunes for a new record. Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, bye.
A new record that never came. We'll be right back right after this.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith, a special retrospective rewind, my interviews with Sonic Youth. And so as the story goes, the band broke up and Kim wrote a memoir, excellent memoir called Girl in a Band. If you haven't read it, it is essential reading for any kind of music, rock, or, you know, any kind of reader fan. It's worth your time. If you're listening to this podcast, it's worth your time. So that happened, and Kim went sort of solo, but also teamed up with Bill Nace, and they created the offshoot Body Head, and I caught up with them backstage at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville, Tennessee, in this 2014 interview, part two of Kyle Meredith with Sonic Youth.
Hi.
So we're at the Big Ears Festival here in Knoxville, Tennessee, which you guys are a part of, and it seems like that there is no more perfect festival created that you guys could be a part of than what's going on right here. I don't know what we say. It's like innovators or those folks who are skirting the art and pop world, and you fit in.
Yeah, we're just sort of zooming around the edges of everything.
Yeah. Well, do you see yourself as part of a club that's going on here?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, we're literally like, yeah, we're kind of...
I don't know what are we.
Oh, we don't have to categorize what you are.
We never feel like we're actually in the club, wherever the club, whatever the club
yeah.
is.
Yeah, I just don't see like for a lot of festivals, there's you couldn't take a yearbook photo of it, but this one, it seems like you could actually take a nice yearbook photo of everyone, and it's going to make sense.
Right,
you
know? Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's this type of music, it's what's going on here that I guess it's, I mean, could you ever imagine anything like this ever going, mainstream's probably not the right word, but somewhere like the accessibility and everything, because there's really interesting stuff. And I guess what I'm getting to is, you know, you guys aren't what I'd say a rock band, and everybody here is not a rock band, but in the realm of rock and pop, you know, you hit those walls every few years, and it takes something moving it forward, and it feels like we could get something out of this. These are the artists that are trying that, but do you ever feel like these are the artists who could ever be, I don't know, what's a good example?
I think that idea, though, of the mainstream kind of breaking into that in that way is a little, like, not as relevant nowadays. It's more about like access, which is I think easier than it used to be to kind of, you know, check out a wide array of things.
I mean, I guess you don't need a radio hit anymore just to be
right
to make a living, you know,
or to not make a living.
Right.
Did you make a living off your radio hits? That's a good question.
We didn't have any radio hits.
Yeah,
but no, I mean, I think that there's something interesting about, you know, maybe eccentricity is a kind of a way you could describe even some of the bands that are playing.
Yeah.
You know, like Television.
Right.
But I think it's just kind of accumulated, people getting sort of years of that, you know, dissonance and that kind of music, like, filtering up and... you know, I think basically anything can also be marketed.
Sure.
You know, like the Red Bull Academy did this festival that, I mean, I don't know how many people actually went. It wasn't like Lollapalooza or anything.
It was
but they called it drone music, which I would never, I think very specifically drone music as like, you know, minimalist classical music. Mm-hmm. Or the Velvet, I guess I can see how people think Velvet Underground is drone music, but I don't think of that.
I don't think of it as drone. Well, I mean, we look at it as history books now, so it's through that filter.
Yeah,
you know,
but people seem to have glommed onto that word as something that is...
Well, didn't we just call it shoegaze at one point? There was a catch-all with shoegaze as well, that if it
yeah,
just
well, that
was
more pop, though.
Yeah, slow and murky, and it's like it was shoegaze, you know?
Yeah.
I just think having improvised music at a festival is kind of, you know, not the norm.
It's not jam band improvised music.
Right.
It's not like free jazz or something like that.
Right.
No, but we're improvised, and I'm not sure. I imagine the Hino trio has some improvisation going on.
Yeah.
So I just think to have that at a festival is pretty, you know, not usual, which is nice.
Well, that's a great lead-in, actually, to you guys' record and everything. So it's the debut Buddyhead record. And there is a certain amount of improv into that. And I've read about, you know, that there was some structure to it, but there was also a lot of free range, and how that plays towards the live show. Because when did it come out? I mean, this record's now, what's
September.
Yeah, so what, 7 months or whatever that is. DJ math. It's somewhere in the 12 months or whatever. It couldn't have started out anything like the record, but now what are those, are they completely different? Have you guys found that there is any kind of structure to these songs on any given night?
Well, we're really not playing this. I mean, the record literally was completely improvised.
Okay.
And then, including the lyrics and the vocals, mm-hmm. but then I went back and overdubbed some other lyrics, and we did some shaping and a little bit of editing and a couple of guitar overdubs, but
the only thing that
remains is, well, no, we could never recreate it.
Sure.
It was completely made up in the moment. So, and it's our whole career is that is what we do live on stage.
Yeah.
So the only thing that's really carried over are some lyric ideas.
But
basically, but as far
or
as
just things that we do because it's who we are and that's how we play.
Yeah, like our vocabulary of playing,
sure.
and you know, we're so kind of used to playing together that so I like to think of it as sort of scripted improvisation, mm-hmm. but it's really unscripted improvisation, really.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's what the set list looks like. Like, how does the set list look? You know, does it say abstract on it?
You're
like,
no set list.
That's what I'm getting.
But you know, when we tour in Europe, you know, we you know, for publishing, they always want the names of the songs, so we just put down the names of the songs on the record. I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they wouldn't know.
It's
funny. Bill, I know that you've said in the previous bands you didn't work a lot with vocalists. There wasn't a lot of vocalists. Now, once again, you've had time. You know, what has that been like for you? And have you found new tricks over these months, you know, to how that shapes?
New tricks, how?
Of working with it, because you play to voice. I read an interview that said you've learned how to play to voice, and it's a very different
thing. Oh, no. I wasn't saying I learned how to play to it, more just that it's changed how I play with other people or how I approach it. But, you can kind of get away with more as well in terms of, because the way Kim sings, it kind of ties it together, mm-hmm. and I think it gives it that kind of song quality.
It's the Lebowski rug.
Yeah. Exactly like
Bill's
that.
Bill's favorite movie.
But, so we can, I don't mean get away, but we can kind of work with more abstract musical pieces that then the vocals kind of tie it together and make it something that I don't think it would be without the vocals. So just for me, I had never really played with that much, so it was just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd played with vocalists, but more people that did also like kind of really just, you know, abstract kind of extended technique type of stuff.
I mean, there's a million genres out there and kind of putting in a box of just what we know, you know, usually as rock pop. It's so foreign to hear, like, someone talking about not playing with a vocalist that much.
Right.
And learning it this far into a career.
Right.
The exciting thing about Bodyhead, and I guess with what you guys are saying too, it doesn't really seem like there's a roadmap much at all. I mean, I don't know how you see it. Is this a project or is this your band?
It's our band.
It's band.
It's the band. Is it the band right now, or
we had the name Star Wars.
It's a band.
And I guess that's what I said. You know, and Kim, maybe it's because you know you've been through many projects that we call projects. You know, and I guess that's the splitting hairs, the definitions between what's a band and what's a project. Mm-hmm. And you know, do we get to have more Bodyhead records? You know, down the line and that type of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really done that many projects.
I think project gets used when there's like a main. You know, it's like Free Kitten was a band, but Sonic Youth was happening, so then people kind of...
Sonic Youth was a project, Free Kitten was a band.
Exactly, yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, it's all like where your entry point into that is.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think it means that much.
Yeah. It might not happen on this level, and, you know, maybe this is an awkward question with it, but, you know, have you had any problem finding your place, given, you know, Sonic Youth and the history of everything like that, you know, coming from you... where you are, because there's a spotlight, obviously, when you walk out, and this is a new band, it's Bodyhead, but it's, here's Kim Gordon. Have you found any problem finding a place in it?
Finding a place?
I don't know if saying in the spotlight is the right thing, but just saying, like, this is a duo and not, once again, a project.
No, I mean, I think because it's a duo, there's not much of a issue with that. I mean,
yeah.
you know, it kind of is what it is.
Yeah. Well, Kim, for you then, was it, you know, any means for reinvention? Because there is similarities in sound into what we're used to hearing from you. But did you ever step out and said, I could completely reinvent myself with this?
Well, I don't know, I didn't really think about it so consciously. I just felt like I wanted I liked playing with Bill, and I just thought, oh, great, now I can just play exactly what I want to play.
I'm the captain now.
Playing with only one other person, it's just easier to focus on the music, for one thing. And also, I don't know, I just thought, we're just going to make this music. We didn't really think beyond just going down in the basement and starting to record and then starting to do some shows.
People always want like a narrative of something that's beyond just like,
this is what happened.
I like to play music you know.
We have to fill space sometime.
That's true.
Yeah. No, I mean, I wasn't actually thinking, I was thinking more, I would just concentrate on art, but I did miss playing, and it was fun to do something I thought, you know, I wouldn't have to promote.
Yeah, and here you are.
But, and then if you like it, then you want people to come see it.
Sure. So. Well, we love it, and that's the great thing about this. I mean, luckily it worked. Do you mind if I ask how the book's going? Because there's going to be a bio, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going.
Yeah.
Actually, my deadline is April.
the way you're saying that doesn't sound too promising.
Let's just say I should be at the hotel writing.
Has it been surprising at all how much people, from the moment we heard there was going to be a bio, they were like, I mean, salivating, at the actual story.
I mean, it's not going to be a Sonic Youth bio.
Sure.
So, I mean, there's, you know, things about, of course, writing about different songs and recording and different stories about that, but its purpose isn't to make a Sonic Youth fan totally happy.
Yeah. So you went into it actually.
So just set your bar.
Just like the band.
I want everyone to set their bar low.
Yeah. Did you go into it with that idea? Yeah. Did you have that idea when you went into it, when they said, hey, let's write a book? Did you have to think, what is the book? What's the angle?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you would have to instead of just...
Yeah, you make a proposal.
It. Sure. Yeah, I don't know the book world. Yeah. I don't know how it works. Have you read all of the other like unauthorized biographies that have your life in it?
No.
Did you ever open any of those? Because there's quite a few out there.
They're all really awful. Pretty
are they?
Yeah. They're boring. The only one that's actually, they're not awful, but they're just, you know, they don't have any context to them.
Yeah.
Pretty much. The best one is actually this catalog, Sensational Fix, from a show art exhibit that unfortunately didn't come here because it was the recession was going on. But they went to 7 or 8 museums in Europe, and it was exhibit that had to do with artists we were influenced by and collaborated with.
Yeah.
And just, it was less really about Sonic Youth, but it had individually some of our artwork and some ephemera and stuff from Sonic Youth, but it was a kind of an interesting context for the band, and it's really the best book on Sonic Youth. Byron Coley is going to write the ultimate.
Yeah, it's going to be the one.
You know, like leave those details.
One of these days. Good luck on the April deadline, and thanks for giving us Bodyhead, both of you guys.
Thanks.
It was great meeting you both.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with a retrospective with Sonic Youth. We now arrive in 2018. That's when Kim started dipping her toe into the solo world, as we talked about that, and anniversaries from some Sonic Youth albums like Daydream Nation and A Thousand Leaves, part 3 of Kyle Meredith with Sonic Youth.
Oh, hey, hi.
Let's start out with just, you know, what you've been up to, because the last we heard of you musically was you put out the single Murdered Out, and that was 2016, and it was a one-off single, but I thought at the time, oh, this means that there's more on the way, maybe, a solo record or something, and that assumption was wrong.
Well, I am going to do a solo record.
I'm not sure. I don't think I'm doing it with that person, but who I worked with on that. But it's going to be the person I'm working with is really busy.
Right.
So, I don't know. It might take a while.
Yeah. So no timeline on that. But was that ever the thought when that song came out that that there was going to be more to go with it, or was that always meant to be a one-off?
Well, you know, I just really hadn't. It was just something that happened, so I hadn't really, planned anything more right then. I mean, it was kind of, everything takes so long. and now Bodyhead, we have a record coming out in July 13th on Matador. So.
Oh, with Bodyhead?
Yeah. So if I do have a solo record, it'll be like next year.
You're also on the new Stephen Malcolmist record, I've heard.
Yes, I am.
What's your involvement there? What are you doing on that record?
Oh, I'm just doing a duet. It's like a sort of a faux country song about marriage, I think. Yeah, so that was fun.
Can you tell me about any more about the Bodyhead record while we're here? Is that still?
It's really heavy, and I don't know what to think of the Bodyhead record, but it's. It's quite different than the first one. So, yeah. I don't know. It's just heavy.
Let's do 1,000 Leaves, because this album is turning 20 on May 12th. I don't feel like this is an album that gets celebrated very often. I mean, there's just so many, you know, Sonic Youth records that people turn to, and this one's sort of good. I want to tell you, I had the poster of that on my wall for, like, most of my second half of my teenage years.
Oh, wow.
Take the trip down memory lane. Like, what comes to mind, if anything, when you think back to that record?
Well, I mean, I know that we were, I think it was very influenced by, having our own studio, and we'd been putting out, doing these kind of more instrumental, kind of just more experimental things on SYR. What's our last more kind of really song-oriented record? Was it Dirty? No, it was experimental Jet Set, I think.
Yeah, Jet Set and Washing Machine between this one and Dirty.
Washing Machine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then 1,000 Leaves was after Washing Machine, mm-hmm. or was it? Yeah, that's right. Anyway, I guess we sort of, Washing Machine, I'm talking about another record.
That's all right.
I think we felt like that was a really good recording experience. The recording felt very naturalistic, and, the whole kind of career of Sonic Youth, the whole time people would always say, oh, your records don't sound like you do live, and I think after a while we sort of gave up trying to do that, because also it's kind of dumb because people are listening to something on a giant speaker, and it's just a live experience. It's just totally different. I mean, some people really try to replicate their records, I guess, and that's like a point of kind of honor, or not honor, but to be exacting in that way. And we were never that sort of band anyway. So I think that though there was something about, the recordings that seemed always to separate us from the music, and the feeling of playing live and what the music sounded like playing live. So Washing Machine felt, even though it did have a lot of reverb on things, I think, it did feel like a kind of naturalist kind of sounding record. And so when we went back to our own studio, which actually we could have our own studio because we then toured Lollapalooza and we took some of that money and invested it and made our own studio. So we could then record more, and we started doing this like SYR record because that we didn't want to be put through some like big kind of record company machinery of promotion and blah, 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 blah. Because it's so frustrating. You have to wait so long to put a record out. Anyway, so 1,000 Leaves, I think, was very influenced by that process.
When I look back, especially, 1998, I thought the alt scene, that you guys had released Goo and Dirty in, that sort of drifted out by that point. We're getting into the late 90s, almost to the rap rock and cock rock takeover of radio and everything.
Right.
But I thought, it almost was probably a nice thing for you all, because once that certain spotlight had kind of shifted that way, it seems like it would take the pressure off. Because when I listen to this now, when I listen to A Thousand Leaves now, it almost sounds like one of the first times that Sonic Youth sounded like you were really comfortable and on your own speed.
Yeah, that's. I guess that's what I mean by naturalistic or something. Like, we weren't sort of trying something out that was out of our comfort zone in a way. I mean, you know, we like to record at Sirius Sound because they had like a 2-inch and, you know, it's very analog sounding and all that. But, you know, I even remember the last record we recorded there. I guess maybe it was experimental, like working with Butch Vig. We kind of got into this thing of saying, well, that's good enough, you know, instead of going back and redoing take after take. Because I feel like with like Dirty and Goo, you know, we basically really took the rock thing as far as we could and then ultimately found it sort of less satisfying when we saw where it was kind of going. Like you were saying also, like we kind of just hit a wall with it and then it's almost like we just became more introverted or something. Yeah, so that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, that's when I started loving Sonic Youth the most, when you became introverted.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't even remember what's on that record or what it sounds like, to tell you the truth.
Well, there's three songs that I'll bring up. First, Sunday was the big single off of it, was, I guess, the only single off of it, which, as I look back on now, I don't remember seeing it, but you had Macaulay Culkin in the video?
Right, yeah. It was sort of Thurston and Macaulay Culkin. Oh, okay. I think Harmony shot it, Harmony Korine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see him.
And it was kind of like he had this idea he wanted to do, so...
You know, a couple of your songs that I'll point out, especially because there's always, with a lot of your lyrics, they've held on, they've aged well, and I'm going to say they aged well in really fortunate and interesting ways, because the first track is, I'm going to try to say it, Contre le Sexisme, which I think transfers to Against Sexism, and then the Female Mechanic, and listening to those now, and the things that you were talking about, and all the way back, especially to your very famous line and cool thing that people are holding up on posters everywhere now. You know, this all eventually comes out to the Me Too movement that's been in the last year or 2 years and everything. And I don't know if you have a reaction to that, a feeling of that, but that's got to have some kind of positive effect on you, that I would think.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I actually, but it's sort of like the way the media works, and it's just sort of like, well, sexism didn't just happen now, you know, so, you know, and I don't know, I guess when we signed to major label, I think I really felt like, okay, I actually have a platform here that like, I can write a song about anything. And it almost kind of, I felt challenged by it. Like, I, you know, step up to the plate or something. Like, so many people write love songs or that, and it's kind of like, well, as a woman, I had so many things I could write songs about as subject matter. And like there was like swimsuit issue, you know, like right after we signed at Geffen, I think there was kind of a big A&R person who was called out for sexual harassment, and it was kind of a big deal. And you know, I think we felt, not only had we signed to, like, you know, accused of selling out, signing to a major label, but it was like one that had this particular scumbag, you know, but of course it was just like, he was probably the tip of the iceberg, or, you know, like no one just talked about it. But, you know, I really deeply felt like the sexism coming from this corporate world, and, you know, things like, they'd have like secretary day, but they wouldn't necessarily like give help kind of nurture secretaries into other jobs, or, you know, like promoting them, or, you know, and, you know, so that was kind of, you know, I think it's funny. It's just funny how things come around. They don't go away, you know, and, but I actually had totally forgotten that I'd written that song. Also Female Mechanic, you know, I don't, you know, I just kind of,
I guess what the nice thing, I guess, that I'm trying to say with that is, you know, when we would see those stories in the 90s, it was almost like those people, even if they got in trouble, it would just be like a stern slap on the wrist a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know about the situation you're specifically speaking to, but a lot of times that happened. Whereas now it feels like, you know, whether the huge ball keeps rolling in the way that we all hope it does, but, you know, those mountains are starting to crumble. And like I said, for you to be such a voice of that, and interestingly, with words you said 20 years ago and 25 years ago to still have such an impact and to be so inspiring, you know, to women marching and you know, traveling across the country to walk on Washington.
Yeah, no, I didn't. Like, it was so funny because it was just such a, that inspiration for the Cool Thing lyrics came from a couple different sources. And I almost meant it like, it was just like one of those lyrics on the, they did actually eventually, I guess now they mean something. But I was kind of thinking of I was inspired by a Raymond Pettibone film and Jane Fonda and L. Cool J. You know, like it was, but yeah. It is interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you really think it's, I just feel like, I guess I'm a little pessimistic though. I just kind of feel like people have such short attention spans, and it is like all the sexual harassment stories coming out. It's all kind of built on like such a culture of sexism, you know, that it's so deeply ingrained and it's genetically ingrained. And I don't know, I just hope it still keeps moving forward with some momentum, you know?
Yeah. I think it's just everyone's so starved for that change to finally happen because it's been so long coming. It's such
yeah,
a long
that
time
could
coming.
Be, you know.
Yeah, but at
yeah,
the
it's
same
been
time,
repressed so long.
Yeah, at the same time, we have a dude in the office who has been sued by dozens of women, and nothing
right.
will happen. Nothing will happen.
Yeah, because there's so many kind of white male kind of, you know, small thinkers in the office. And
I don't think we're going to solve the world's problem with that, but I do appreciate you in that sort of idea right there, as I know a lot of folks do.
That's great. Thanks.
So let's turn to another record then, which you pointed out to me. I wasn't paying attention to the 30-year anniversary, but in October, Daydream Nation turns 30 years. And I feel like everything's been said about that record because there are literally books written about that record. How does it sit with you in a catalog, you know, to be held on such a pedestal like that? Like, do you have the same emotions that I think people give that album rise to?
You know, I sort of didn't until we, you know, because once a record's done, you just kind of, you sort of have to forget about it, and then you go out and you play the songs and they take on sort of a new life of their own. But when we did relearn that record and start playing it live again, it had such a different feeling than all our other songs after that. And, you know, it's like it's so dense, and it was actually just such an intense thing to play. But like listening to it, I don't know, it's not as, I didn't get the sense of the songs individually of having that much power, but actually playing the songs was really hard. And in the sense that it was just really a lot of energy, and maybe it was also coming out of being influenced by hardcore and just, you know, super like dense kind of music that was around us.
Yet at that time it ends up being, you know, I guess your most accessibly as a pop record that you guys had ever done, which is interesting that's what the influences were coming from, you know, that you ended up on the charts with
yeah.
that record.
Yeah, it's weird.
Were you aware? I guess I should say, when did you start to become aware that it was taking on that life that it eventually did?
I don't know. You know, it was just a kind of gradual, I guess, because people would mention it as, you know, our best record or something.
Yeah. It's in the Library of Congress now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was a moment. I forgot. No, I remember, being like, we're in Japan or something when they had the Paz and Jap poll, and it was like number one. And I remember being just completely surprised.
I don't know. I mean, to have, you know, we talk about these records, to have something that dominated your life for 30 years and then for it to be done and gone. Do you feel the absence of Sonic Youth, or is it still people like me making it constantly circle around you?
I mean, I don't feel the absence of it because I kind of felt like we sort of took it as far as we could. And I don't know, also I'm just kind of sort of busy with other things. Now able to like pursue making art more, which is kind of the most important thing to me. And also I love playing with Bill. Like I love Bodyhead. You know, I just kind of just I love the freedom of it.
And that's, you know, I'll try not to make that part of this interview too awkward either, because, you know, it's well written about how Sonic Youth kind of came to an end and why it came to an end, you know, without getting into your personal life. But that was sort of the question, you know, like, had Sonic Youth made their final record one way or the other? Was that happening regardless?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. You know, I think, you know, when gets, you know, I think that we had a lot of good times and good moments, and kind of amazing that the band was able to become as big as it was. You know, I just can't imagine what it would be like starting a band now that was, you know, writing songs or indie rock or whatever. And like, I just kind of feel pretty much like, you know, dynamics in a band get old, and it's kind of like, it's better to stop before, you know, it's just all the good times get forgotten, you know?
Right. Right. There's a lot of great music in there. I certainly do appreciate every bit of it. I'm always excited about what you're doing next. Like I said, I thought Murdered Out was I was so taken aback by it. One, it just kind of came out of nowhere, but it was such a good song, and so great to hear you sort of in that style and mode as well. Uh-huh. So,
yeah, no, I would like to do more, actually, with that producer too. I think, you know, I probably will, but I think there'll be like one-offs or something.
Well, I thank you for the time, especially you gave me a lot of time here. I really appreciate that. But
oh, sure.
Yeah, and I look forward to the new Body Head. So maybe we can catch up more when that happens. And we'll
yeah, definitely.
We'll get Bill on the phone too and make it a big thing.
Cool. All right.
Well, take care. Is there anything else we should know about? Actually, I should ask, you just did an art show, so I didn't know if you had any more of those coming up. That was
oh yeah. Well, it's up until the 28th in LA. There's like there's actually a kind of a narration part to it, as well as the painting and sculpture, and there's like sound effects in the room and stuff.
Where is it?
It's at this gallery in LA called Rena Spalling's Fine Art. They have one in New York, and then they share the space with another gallery from Mexico City. They kind of, every other month, they curate a show. And yeah, I'm really happy with it.
Yeah, and how long is that up?
Till April 28th.
Well, awesome. I don't think I can get to April in that time, but I hope some of our listeners can. So,
yeah.
Awesome, Kim. Well, thank you so much again, and it was great talking to you.
You too. Have a great day.
Kim Gordon in 2018. Now, 1 year later, in 2019, she and I caught up again to talk about that debut solo album finally coming out, No Home Record, where she also dug into her love of 80s hip-hop and Fleetwood Mac, part 4 of Kyle Meredith with Sonic Youth.
Hey.
I don't have to say that I'm a huge fan and I've been waiting for this record for a long time, but I am a huge fan and I've been waiting for this record for a long time, and it sounds so good. I'm so happy. Yeah, I'm so happy to hear this this solo record. Congratulations on this. It's awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah. Glad you like it.
Yeah, I was reading an interview with you recently as you're talking about this, and I'm taking it out of context a little bit, but you said art is at its most commercial right now. And I think you were talking about decorative arts along the lines of the Airbnb stuff, but I kind of wonder, though, if that's the case, do you find that that also influences how you come about to a record like this?
Well, I was talking about the New York art world as being more commercial than it's ever been, and maybe I was contrasting it with L.A., which isn't as commercial because Hollywood money isn't like Wall Street money. But, I mean, the Airbnb thing is more about, I guess, seeing what people's idea of art is, I mean, obviously they're decorating their house and they're treating art. There is a lot of high art that is basically decoration, or once you see it in a corporate lobby or something, it doesn't really have any, I don't know, often it just looks like decoration to me. Then, you know, when you use prints and reproductions of paintings, and it is becomes something else. And then when it matches the bedspread and the towels and the rugs, and you get kind of semblances of what might have been African art, which is now like a porcelain elephant or something, like in some, I don't know, it's just kind of interesting to me. Maybe I'm just a sociologist. And
well, I guess, and what I was, of course, trying to do was tie it back to the music, because, you know, in the past few years, you put out these really amazing records with Body Head, which, you know, finds you in more of a freeform structure. You know, it's a lot of improv in that, and this takes you back mm-hmm. to the pops, you know, I guess we can call it a pop structure.
is closer to what you're in now? And not that you have to pick one or the other, but do you find that you're more comfortable in one than the other?
Well, they're just different. I mean, playing with Bill Nace and Buddy Head, it's just kind of fun, pure fun. And, you know, it doesn't have like all these, I mean, it has its own built-in expectations, I guess. Maybe that's more for Bill, or that he knows the scene more of like noise music and all that. But I don't really have to pay attention to it. So it's kind of freeing for me. And I don't know, this was just kind of experiment. I don't listen to that much pop music, but, you know, I like rap and, you know, I like songs, and I listen to all kinds of super mellow music from the past, you know, whether it's Neil Young or Fleetwood Mac, Tusk, Steve Gunn, and Kurt Vile too. You know, like I don't sit down and put on a noise record at home so much. It's more something I'd go see as for the experience of it.
Well, there's a Fleetwood Mac, you mentioned that. They get kind of a little nod in there. And it was Tusk, right? It was Tusk that you kind of, that led you to them?
Tusk, yeah.
That's an
interesting... most hated record.
It just turned 40. It's on its 40th anniversary, I think, this week. Not that that's here nor there, but it's kind of interesting that that's the one you centered in on. It's a cool record. It's different.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I mean, I hear Fleetwood Mac all over now. Like, it's like you can't escape it.
You'd also mention hip hop there for a second. Paprika Pony, I think, gets really close to, you know, with that beat that's happening behind that. It reminds me of the old school style. And you all were always early champions of hip hop and rap before it was widely accepted. Where did that come from for you? Was that just primarily a New York thing and your accessibility to it?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely, it was a New York thing. And then, you know, of course, God, I remember talking to Rick Rubin when he was still an NYU student living in a dorm, and he was telling me about he was going to record this, like, rap artist in his dorm room. And I was like, yeah, right, Rick. And, you know, he just became, like, this huge producer. But, no, you know, I like the LL Cool J's radio that was very minimal. And, you know, just like it's kind of in New York, you hear so much music pouring out of people's cars and just kind of a cacophony of mixed genres at times, you know, Madonna and then some rap and Run DMC.
Was that actually a touch point when you were going into a song like Paprika Pony, or is it coincidence?
I mean, I kind of, you know, I relate to hip hop or rappers per se, as I'm not like the best singer or like a biggest range or big on melody, more of a rhythm kind of person. I like also that it's kind of punk, and that you don't have to be a muso or like know much about music. You can kind of make it through appropriation, and or at least that's the way it started, and kind of, you know, had this do it yourself aspect to it, really, which was pretty punk. And I like a lot of Chicago hip hop.
You know, with the book now in the past, but do you find does the lyrics update the story at all? That's directly related to where you left off in the book.
No, I don't know. I didn't really like. I mean, I feel like that was several years ago, and I don't know. It has more to do with this kind of text I started writing or wrote for an art show about pitching a TV show, and just kind of it was an excuse to make observations about other things and throw it into the mix. And I guess, yeah, I wasn't really thinking of it in that way. You could.
We do, because, you know, if you're a fan, we kind of hang on to the words, and of course we're going to try to draw the connections. So it's, but I don't have to be right, obviously. What about the live band? What's the live show on this gonna sound like? I mean, are you specifically taking this album out on the road? And if so, who's playing with you?
Well, yeah, I have to put a band together. A couple of different people played drums, but there are only drums on a couple songs. So it'll probably have someone will be like kind of putting it together with me in terms of being able to use backing tracks and or files and mixed with some live musicians, and it might be more of a like an art performance vibe, but I don't know. It'll be weird.
I hope so. Is there any reason to play any of your older songs that you took the vocals on for Sonic Youth when you're out there?
No. I mean, I can't really think of, I don't have any desire for that. I mean, even if I played all the songs on this record, it's only 40 minutes, so I have to think of some way to maybe write some new songs or something. But I can't really think of any Sonic Youth songs that I'd be able to pull off unless I just did it a cappella.
Right. I wouldn't complain. We're close to a bull in the heather here. It gets played all the time here in Louisville just because of the Kentucky Derby and everything. That's become a bit of a yearly anthem. And the mythology that runs out of that, because was it one of the guys from Pavement used to live over here? I forget which one. And there was always this...
Bob.
Yeah, Bob. And there was always a rumor that you all had come to one of his parties during the Derby. But did that ever happen?
No. Never went to his party. So.
Dispelling that right now, finally.
But we did a lot of gigs with Pavement, so.
Could have worked
out. Every night was a party. A ping pong party.
A ping pong party?
Yeah, kind of.
Just like with the table?
Yeah, I mean, well, they had on Lollapalooza, they had a ping pong table.
I think I've seen some of that video, the video footage. All right. Congratulations on the record. I love it so much, and it's so great to hear from you, and I can't wait to catch one of these weird shows that you're going to put on.
Thanks, Kyle.
Kim Gordon from 2019. All right, and to wrap this Sonic Youth journey up, we arrive in 2020. That's when I sat down with Thurston Moore to discuss By the Fire, his solo record that he put out that year, and one that found him taking inspiration from the Rolling Stones and the Replacements. We get into that and a whole lot more. It's part five of Kyle Meredith with Sonic Youth.
How's it going?
I want to throw you the compliments right at the top because By the Fire is an incredible record. There is not one moment on here that I don't love.
Fantastic. Oh, that's so good to hear. Thank you. Appreciate that.
There's a lot going. I feel like this is a record where maybe you're allowing yourself, whether you do that or not always other times anyways, but it seems like you're allowing showing all of your sides all in one record. Like it's not just maybe the experimental record or the noise record or the pop record or whatever, but it's all there. Was that part of the plan or is that coincidence?
The record was taken from a few different sessions that happened in the last couple of years, last year or so. So it's not a record where it's a singular session. It has that focus that a lot of records will have usually, where it's one studio, it's one session of material that the musicians are performing and releasing, which is usually how I work. And it's Sonic Youth worked mostly like that. For this record, it was a little different, and I was somewhat informed and intrigued by Exile on Main Street, you know, the Rolling Stones record from the early 70s, which I remember buying as a kid when it came out, and always thinking that record had a very sort of singular kind of vocabulary to it. It was like of its time, that record. I remember the critics really trounced on it when it came out. It was this double album and with this weird black and white sleeve of like all these different images from... through history, and the music was rather messy and all over the place, but it for me it sounded like it came from one great mess. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to hear an interview with Mick Jagger when they re-released the record, and he did a bit of electronic press kit of sorts, and he said actually the record was a bit of a pastiche. He took some tracks that fell by the wayside during the Sticky Fingers sessions. And then there's some stuff they did in their infamous French studio, the mobile recording situation they had there. And then there were some other spurious pieces. And Jagger sort of put this record together. It was this double album that just sort of flowed the way it flowed. And it made me think about like, oh, well, so that's why that record had had a bit of a strange dynamic in a way, you know, in the way it was sequenced. And then I started thinking about there's this record by the Replacements called Let It Be. I think it was in the late 80s, early 90s. And that record also, I remember specifically hearing that it had come from a few different sessions that the band had done around Minneapolis. And I really love that dynamic of that record because you could hear the production values sort of shift from song to song. And it kind of gave the record a bit of a reckless quality, but each song was kind of a bit of a nugget. And that really impressed me. So I was sort of thinking along those lines when I was making this record. I probably had enough material for like from one session to make a pretty solid single album. But I wanted to really, like you said, I wanted it to be a bit of a wider story, a bigger story than just like this one time in the studio. because so much has happened in the last year and a half leading into like where we are now, which is like, it's such a chaotic world right now. Not that it's never has been chaotic, but now it's especially kind of anxious and it's more of a shared kind of vibe that we have together. Everybody's sort of experiencing their own personal experience in isolation and then having this communication that we use through technology to sort of stay connected while we're kind of being quarantined from each other. That's something that none of us have really ever experienced. Right. And that kind of feeling is really, it's big. And I wanted this record to be slightly bigger and have a story that didn't have that focus. I wanted it to be multi-focused. So, I mean, that was kind of the idea, is like to have a record like this. So I took songs from about three different sessions, and I pretty much sequenced it with the songs that I thought would work with a narrative that I thought was something I wanted to share. And so it starts out kind of with these sonic rock tunes to some degree, and it gets a little more contemplative with these pieces of music I just recorded myself in a studio in France. And those first tunes I recorded here in a small studio in London. And then there's this larger piece of music that I had recorded during the rock and roll consciousness sessions from a couple of years ago at this beautiful studio in London called The Church, which was engineered and produced by Paul Epworth, who is a producer of note, as we know, with Adele and Florence and the Machine. And then there was this other material I did at a more funkier place here in London called Total Refreshment Center, which is a fantastic smaller studio that I like using. So it had these different production qualities. And I sequenced the record like that, and it sort of ends with this the only instrumental on the record, which is this guitar piece that's a pattern piece that kind of just continues to get more and more open and heavy, and then it sort of dissipates into this kind of harmonic, mellifluous kind of thing, and it just goes away. So I wanted the record to be this kind of story that sort of had some kind of hope at the end, and putting something out there that was had a good energy, because there's so much whack energy out in the air right now that I think that's really, that was the political move, let's put it that way.
It's funny, your answer right there is like the overture of this interview, because there's so many parts of that.
Feel free to cut me off anytime.
Not necessary, because you hit on so many points that I find really important in this one, and I'm just going to sort of randomly choose one here, because first off, hearing that you're working with Paul Epworth, you know, that can be a little surprising to some people until you realize that there have sort of been those moments throughout your career. I don't know if this was actually part of those, but one of the first surprising moments to me when I was listening to this is when you get into Cantaloupe and you're rocking there, and suddenly like a classic rock guitar solo emerges. Oh, yeah. Which is not something I expected at
that's
this
not
time.
Me though. Yeah. That's James Edwards, the guitar player I play with here.
Yeah.
He's this incredible shredder. But his favorite guitar players are Jimmy Page and Lydia Lunch. And his favorite bands are Zeppelin, Sonic Youth, and The Fall. You know, so he has this really kind of way open kind of head. And he's this high technique guitar player. And I kind of undervalue him. He plays in unison with these weird tuning songs I have. And I let him stretch out a bit, but you know, it's like all I have to do is say, James, can you go in and maybe put down a lead on this section here? I think it would be really good with some kind of other lead. And he did that in one take. Uh-huh. You know, and it was one of those things where the room went still. I was like, what? Like, who are you? Where do you come from? He's great.
But it's interesting, like, again, like, do you think there was ever a point in your career where you would have ran from that, though? Like, having that sort of a traditional solo in the middle of one of your songs? Because, again, it works. I love it.
Yeah, it does work. And I've always loved that. I've always loved really, like, super tasty, juicy, hot rock and roll playing. And Sonic Youth never really incorporated that so much. I mean, we alluded to it because I think we of course love that kind of music, but we didn't play like that. None of us were really brought up playing like that. I think Lee was the most sort of like, had the most sort of high technique kind of skill base. in Sonic Youth, as far as that was concerned. And then Steve Shelley, of course, as well, when he comes into the group, you know, as a drummer, he had the skills to pay the bills. So it was sort of that was what the voice of Sonic Youth was. We weren't ever trying to sort of replicate those kind of traditional motifs so much in our music. In fact, yeah, we would run from them, or you would really want to sort of make mincemeat out of them or do something else with them. I remember Lee putting down a really beautiful guitar line on the song, like in the 90s on one of our records. And it was just like, I remember we were hair on the back of your neck standing up, and it was just like, God, that was such a wonderful Neil Young-ish kind of thing you just did. But it wasn't, it wasn't slavish to like being Neil Young at all, but it was completely informed by it. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of what we were all about at that time. And, James can sort of like lay down a lead like that and it sounds like him, you know, but you can hear it and you're just like, that is rock. That's rock and roll.
It is rock
and roll. For me, coming into playing music, you know, as a teenager, coming into New York in the 70s, and, you know, there was two factors that were happening at the same time in symbiosis. And it was like this real sort of rock and roll purity that you were hearing from bands like the Heartbreakers, you know, or even Patti Smith's group. We're like a rock and roll band. They're like in a bar with like this really amazing singer who was just from somewhere else. You know, and the Ramones just like loving to be, they're just a rock and roll band playing like four chords, you know, it's just this really streamlined thing, really minimal, you know. And it was sort of like, It was happening at the same time as all this other more sort of experimental ideas that were coming out of a band like, say, Talking Heads, or even something as radical as a band like Suicide. So you would have like the Dead Boys playing like this really straight up Stooges rock and roll on the same bill as like Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, which was just like, it was as if this band picked up their instruments that morning and sort of created a band just by slamming on, you know, and it was great. So those two things really were like what it was all about for people like me coming into New York, is like wanting to sort of have that incorporation, that unified idea of like pure rock and roll traditional ideas and then experimentation, like mm-hmm. real just like liberation to in experimentation. And that was that's been the format of everything I've always done through Sonic Youth to now, is like having that forum, that context of a traditional rock and roll band, two guitars, bass, drums, vocals, and then bringing in all this, any kind of experimentation that you want into that group without getting rid of the guitars. I mean, you can experiment with the guitars and do all this. That's the easiest thing, sticking the drumsticks and the screwdrivers under the strings. That's really easy. Anybody can do it. But to do it in a way that sort of is creating a equal value to rock and roll and pure experimentation is really, that's kind of the work, and that's what I still am, feel like I'm in apprenticeship with, you know, like I never feel like I've finished investigating this, you know. So it like this record is just completely, if it's specific to anything, it's that continued investigation into these different ideas.
But at the same time, and I'll kind of flip, you know, the question here, you know, what you would have ran away from those days versus these days, like now you've got basically 40 years, I guess, of catalog behind you, of songs that you've written. And like, there are moments on here that, because of you're the songwriter and you were a songwriter in Sonic Youth, that I'm going to hear, oh, that kind of reminds me of these moments.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like Hashish right from the beginning, I was thinking, what is that? Is that a little bit of Murray Avenue in there? Is that a little bit of Daydream Nation in there?
Like, well, a lot of people said that. They were like, oh, it sounds like Sunday from Sonic Youth or something.
Yeah. Like, do you
and
hear
I was like,
those
of course
moments?
It does.
Yeah, that's yeah, what yeah. I was going to say. Do you hear those moments and you're like, as you're writing them, go like, oh yeah, that's there. I've yeah. sort of been here before.
Yeah, those are motifs. I feel like that's my language, my tongue. I like, you know, I like recognizable music, you know, the whole thing of like, when people were like, reggae music, it all sounds the same, or country and Western, it all sounds the same. Yeah. That's why I like it. I like music that sort of has a shared language within its culture, within its genre. It's like a community of people just sort of like exchanging this kind of these variables of like this one idea. I think that's really strong. I love that. I loved hardcore, like early 80s hardcore, where it was like this really formula that sort of happened with this this kind of thrash into skank kind of thing, and these 1 minute songs, and where the lyrics were just like the emotions on the sleeves of these primarily young men, you know, like 18-year-olds. And they were very, you know, really serious and thinking about the ethics of their life, you know, and what the expectations are in society for, you know, in like Reagan's America at the time, you know. I love that because they did all sound the same, but I love that because there was like these variations in this one shout that right. I thought, I just love that. And so to me, I'm always sort of thinking about the music that intrigues me, informs me, whatever. And I'm not, I never wanted to be experimental just for the sake of being experimental. I like challenging myself. And I think there's, I do that, but I do sort of like, I like the recognizability factor that you will hear in anything. And like when you hear Lou Reed's voice, you know, it's like, why do you sing the same on every song? Because he's Lou Reed.
Not that I would ever say that, you know, all of your stuff sounds like, obviously it doesn't. I think that's one of the things I've appreciated about your songwriting through the years is that there is an experimental, like you're going to open me up and your music has, it's opened me up to so many different sounds that, you know, as a kid who grew up in rural Kentucky that I would not have been aware of beforehand, but yet I can sort of almost count on a hook, even if it's not a chorus rolling around at some point, you know, something to grab onto. And I'll say that even for the instrumentals, like do you, when you're making instrumentals, do you have an image in mind going into those or does an image come later?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I compose pieces like that, it really is just sitting down in a room on a couch with a guitar and just sort of really just allowing myself just to be completely free and open and just start creating. Sometimes something starts happening, sometimes it doesn't. And if I find something that will start happening, I'll reach for my mobile device and I'll try to record it with one hand and play the other. Cause I don't really have like a recording setup. I'm not like a tech geek at all. I don't have anything. And I wish I used to have a little Radio Shack cassette player and I would just like hit that. I don't even have that anymore. I do realize like when something's working and I try to focus on it and I come back to it and I'll spend either all of 1 hour doing it or I'll spend like a month doing it. You know, there's no set way. And, you know, songwriting for me is just, it's really, it's a very sort of metaphysic thing. It's something that happens that's due to almost every aspect in the moment, you know, the environment, your own sort of emotional world, anything that can be happening, you know, in the cosmos, you know, it's just like, I don't question it. You know, so I Keith Richards talks about it in his book Life, which I thought was, so one thing that really stuck with me in that book, I mean, there's a few things that stuck with me in the book, but that he does talk about songwriting in the book that I've never really read in any other music book that talks about the process of songwriting. And he just sort of talks about like, it can happen in 5 seconds or it takes like, you know, 5 years to get this one riff together. And he says, it's just like, I find like sometimes, if I'm out and about and I come back into where I live and I sit down, I pick up the guitar and the first thing I do is like, it's like, there it is. And I try to stop and capture that. If I'm sort of just ambling around the house all day and I was like, oh, maybe I'll sort of play guitar and it's just like, there's nothing there. It really has a lot to do with energy, you know, and it's like this kind of metaphysic energy that's sort of in your life. I don't think there's any real sort of, one contested way of songwriting that anybody can sort of analyze that I know of, unless you're just a technician who's computer songwriting. I don't know.
Well, I'll bring it back around to really won the title because I do want to hear about, you know, how this all does talk about the moment that we're in. It's a playful title, obviously. By the fire is the communal thing as we're all sitting around telling our stories. I've heard you kind of explain it this way. Yeah. And also, I'm standing beside a very big fire right here in the United States alone, yeah, as is happening all over the world. You've called this 9 Songs of Enlightenment. You even used the word hope earlier in the way the record kind of sums up. But what is the enlightenment? Like, how does that all speak together within that idea right there, all the songs?
I wanted the record to sort of be I wanted to be this evocative story that was personal to my own sort of welfare. But I didn't, you know, I certainly, it's not a strict narrative. It's not a rock opera. For me, sort of putting work out there that, for any reason, right now, especially, I think it's always, it's intrinsically a political move. You know, I find, anybody who works with creative impulse and as a musician or a visual artist or filmmaker, and if you're putting work out there as an exchange, as a social exchange, it's inherently political. It's a political move, and so I find that's why I always find making records, being in a band, to be completely something that you need to have a modicum of responsibility in that exchange. It's not something I ever thought about or articulated in my younger years. I think now that I'm in my early 60s, I do think about this, and I sort of see it for what it is. And more so that you have, as an artist, a responsibility to sort of offer something that is about the dignity of exchange. People are buying your music. Maybe they're not, but it is this. It's a public exchange. It's a social engagement, and so that realization for me, more so than ever, puts me into this place. It's like there's so much toxic noise in the world right now, with the encroachment of totalitarianism that you see happening in the USA and to some degree in other countries in England, and to counter it with anything that sort of is about at least benign intellect. You know, or benign creativity is all in good measure. I mean, I think of my music as being music that is coming into the social system as something that is progressive minded. It has sort of a progressive consciousness, and it's first and foremost, it's about harmony. It's about the heart. You know, it's about recognizing that most people that you interact with in the world are desirous of harmonious coexistence and understanding of the true nature of migration. I mean, people always will have and always will be migrating as nature migrates. And I always think about that. It's just like you don't stop that. You realize it and you understand it and you work with it. You don't arrest it. And so, which is what is definitely going on right now in the culture. And it's creating nothing but discord and animosity and division, and as we've been seeing, and ultimately violence, and violence is like the worst product of any kind of situation. But that's all you're seeing right now. And so for me, it's like I was really happy that this record was coming out at this time. I really wanted it to come out as soon as possible. And I was happy to see it come out at the same time as like Public Enemy's new record and Bob Mould's new record. And there's a band here in England that everybody finds a lot of good energy with called The Idols, and they have a new record out. And so that community for me was really important. And that community of voices, different voices together, coming out at a time when there's all this really sort of toxic voices coming out all the time in the media, from these kind of crime bosses that we're dealing with. And so I find, you know, most people I sort of deal with are always trying to give voice to those progressive voices that are out there. I already sent my vote in from overseas, you know, and my vote was all about like wanting to give voices at the table. Mm-hmm. So I know that my vote is going for the faction that I think will give voice to progressive voices that appeal to me, you know, the Ilhan Omars and the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes and the Ayanna Presleys and the Bernie Sanders of America. It's like, who will let them through their front door? I think, well, I'm going to vote for this faction that may possibly do that more than the other.
Right. No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that you all have been a part of that conversation. I say you all, of course, meaning Sonic Youth too, for, you know, the entirety of your career back when we were dealing with the similar things during the Reagan era, you know, and while we were dealing with similar things in the 90s and in the 2000s and in the 2010s, I don't know if that's if it looks like the conversation has changed for you, but I appreciate that you all have, and you have always been on the front line.
Well, it's always been activist. I mean, I think we've always been activist conscious. I mean, you know, it has changed because it's like, it's not, it used to be about sort of dealing with the cycles of political representation. I mean, you know, you could, you know, whatever, you know, you thought Reagan represented it or whatever Nixon represented or whatever the Bush family represented, that was not in accord with like how you thought like civic services should be run. And so you voted more for these, more maybe for like, you know, the Democratic ticket of, you know, of Obama and Carter and, mm-hmm. you know, so it would be these cycles that would sort of like swing, you know, through the years, and you go through enough decades, you sort of see that historical swing, and you try to explain to younger people, your children, it's like, we've gone through these things. We'll, you know, we'll come out the other end. We'll be okay. We went through like, you know, our parents went through World War II, for God's sakes, you know, we survived, we come through. It's quite different now because you're not really dealing with a political structure anymore. You're dealing with what was once a political structure that has been hijacked for the most part by something that's extremely threatening and criminal. So to sort of have, you know, a situation where you have like a racist landlord running the country. Right. That's quite different. And, you know, and then the sort of and not recognizing or allowing any debate over what is obviously a global threat of just like the earth, the health of the planet. Mm. You know, and that's something that we've always, I remember dealing with as a child with like the ecology movement, you know, it was just like, that was very, you know, in a way that was a quaint kind of thing, but it was like, it was always there, but now it's knocking at the front door big time. Obviously. I don't know how it isn't where you are in Louisville.
I was in a house that got flooded 2 times in 5 years, 3 times in 5 years, you know, and it was supposed to be once every 10 to 20 years. I mean, it's happening here. It's happening everywhere. And I echo you, because what was frustrating is it really did seem like once Obama got going that we were starting to move in a faster positive direction, that just the rug is now yanked. And yeah, no, it is everywhere.
So, are you friends with Bob Nastanovich?
I don't know Bob. No, I know the legend of Bob and, you know, and everything of here. But I'd never met him. I know about the Derby parties and everything, you know, it's funny. I was just talking about that recently with Malcolmus, who I had on the show.
With Malcolmus, yeah, because when we think Louisville, we think Bob.
Yeah.
Now we think of you.
I'll quickly ask, because I know you got a couple things coming up that you've kind of hinted at. The book, Sonic Life.
Yeah. Oh, you know about that. I mean, I have been sort of talking about it. I wasn't quite sure how much that information is in this.
There was in a recent interview that you mentioned that you were working on the book, and it might be out maybe just sometime after all this.
With all this downtime, I was supposed to tour all summer. I had a lot, you know, and I tour and travel all the time. I have since like the early 80s, and it's like it's always been nonstop. And which it's just, you know, that's the work. And so that work is, you know, for most musicians, touring is their primary revenue, more so than any record sales, you know, unless you're kind of like some upper echelon, high profile, million selling artist. It's the work you do as a touring artist is where you can sort of pay the rent. And that's just not happening for anybody right now. It's completely worrisome. It's curious to see sort of how people are sort of utilizing Bandcamp more and trying to sort of find ways of just sort of creating digital and physical music and product that they can sell and keeping attention on that. And I think that's been pretty healthy in its own way, but it doesn't really fulfill sort of that daily measure for people who work in music. So I think we all know how to, or we can learn to adjust to things, you know. I'm not quite sure how that's going to pan out. What I've been doing is, besides just being in the same kind of contemplative single space as most of us are, I started focusing on a project that I've been thinking about for years and years and years, which is like to essay and write about music in the sense of the documentation of music that informs somebody to actually want to become a musician, make that the vocation for your life? Like, what is that? Like, what leads you into that? And it's not just sort of like, oh, I want to be a big rock and roll star after seeing, like, you know, the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan or something like that. I mean, I think people do have those dreams, but nobody really sort of can do that because you'll perish. So it's like, what is it really that kind of leads somebody to sort of like actually walk into that zone of just like, I'm going to do this? And for me, it was all about being informed by work and the documents and what is that work. And so I wanted to write at length about, let's say, like the very first Patti Smith 7-inch, like Hey Joe, Piss Factory, that Lenny Kaye released on Murr Records, and mm-hmm. and you know, Robert Mapplethorpe paid for it, and there's a lot of story there, you know. And so I want to write at length about like what that experience was of receiving that totem at the time in 1974, 75. Like I was maybe 14, 15 or whatever, and sending away for that recording after seeing it written about in like Roxine or Cream or a New York music magazine. And knowing that it was a rock writer, because Patti Smith was a byline, I used to see her name as a rock writer in all lowercase, and her writing was really quite distinct from everybody else's. And it was this really kind of prosaic and kind of like wild the pieces of literature. And at that time, for me, rock writers, the journalists, they were as significant as the artists they were writing about. I mean, their voices had the same energy as Lester Bangs' voice had as significant an energy as the Captain Beefheart's voice that he was writing about, or Iggy Stooges. And so, you know, if Lester Bangs had made a record in 1973 or 74, I would have been on top of that thing, you know, because it's like, I wanted to hear more from this person as much as I wanted to hear more from Iggy. So for this person, Patti Smith, to actually make a record produced by this other rock writer, Lenny Kaye, who was also fascinating, that needed to be heard. And I remember listening to it, and it was completely and utterly jarring, come shocking and wonderful and just otherworldly, because it was raw and minimal, and it was super economical. Like they didn't spend that much money making this record, and it was in this little sleeve that she had, it was just a white paper sleeve, no picture, and that she had just sort of signed her name on top of. And at that time, the music culture was primarily pretty grandiose. It was definitely, yes, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and you know, even Allman Brothers Band or whatever. It was like, it was this kind of very sort of grandiose music that was happening. And to hear this kind of, this very urban recitation on this record with Tom Verlaine just sort of scratching this guitar out and these two little miniatures, that was completely remarkable. And so I wanted to write about like what that meant at that time period for like a teenager to hear, and knowing that he had some kind of access to the city where that record came from, and to actually, and then all the other documents that lead you to actually locating that city and what that city was at the time, you know, just the geography of it and the environment of it. And then all the literature and the magazines, the writers, the different, all that cavalcade of records that started happening coming out of that, right? The first Ramones album, Pistols record, everything, and then all these other smaller records that are happening everywhere, you know, the No Wave records on Less and Less. So I wanted to write a bit of a psychogeography that was talking about these documents as the things that inform music and the musicians making it at that time, in that time period, and what it meant personally to me to interact with it, engage with it, and then sort of meeting people in New York that leads to the formation of this band in 1980-81, Sonic Youth. And then it sort of just becomes, yeah, you know, tour, 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 record, record, record. And it's boring as hell because I don't really want to write about that. But I, you know, I'll get to it. I really want to write about like what leads up into that kind of discovery. So that's what Sonic Life is about. And I'm just writing it. I don't have, you know, I'll probably publish it in a year or so. I don't know.
It sounds like a great story. That's exactly what I want to hear from. So I'll be
looking forward to it. Oh, good.
I'll be looking forward to it. Thurston, I want to go ahead and compliment you once again on By the Fire. Man, it's so good what you're doing. I enjoy everything that you do. So thank you so much for continuing to do what you do and for taking the time to talk about it today too, man.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you. I hope I can get to Louisville again soon.
I hope you can. I once waited outside of Headliners, a place with a little crash plane in the background.
Yeah.
That was one of those moments when I was younger that I waited and waited and waited out there. And you all did. You finally came out because there's no green room at Headliners. And I got you to sign my CDs and everything. And,
sweet.
And I think Jim was with you guys at that point. And I remember having one of the, I think it was Evol, and he wouldn't sign it. He's like, no, I'm not on that. I can't sign it. But he drew a little smiley face on it for me.
So. At least he didn't ask me to sign like a Marlboro pack or something. Yeah, no. some people do that. Like, sign my dollar bill.
Whatever like, I have, right. Whatever
is
I have.
Is there anything worse I can sign?
Right. No, I appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Cool. Thanks so much.
We'll see you around. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
And there it is, a 10-year journey with Sonic Youth from 2010 all the way to 2020. So thanks to Thurston, Kim, and Lee, and of course, thanks to you for checking out the episode. Before you get out of here, you made it this far, hit that subscribe button so you can get new interviews just like this one every single week at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions. Anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And again, please do give this series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s, the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, the DBs, Lenny Kravitz, Lucinda Williams, the Pixies, Speech, Nirvana, Cardigans, Jim Blossoms, Peter Cat Recording Company, Muna, Underground System, Art Alexakis, Not a Surf, Bird Talker, John Hyatt, Tom Petty, The Tragically Hip with Feist, Sports Team, and my interview with Kim Deal of The Breeders. That's what you can hear when you tune in weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.